Caesar. Julius Caesar. With Ray and Cap. Caesar was a vampire. Don't make me pull a Sulla. Life of Caesar.
Can you hear me?
All right. I'm getting my Texas on.
Oh my God.
Even though I know Mike Duncan's not from Texas and doesn't live there anymore.
I was going to say, no. Because nobody could do a Wisconsin. No one could do a Wisconsin accent. It's much more fun to do a Texas.
Yeah, what is a Wisconsin accent? I should.
Who knows?
I've done a series of podcasts with the Secretary of State of Wisconsin. Doug La Follette. Yeah, he's good friends with J. David Markham, and the three of us did a series of podcasts late last year about politics in the US. Yeah.
Huh.
And you can check it out if you go to go to CameronRiley.com.
Right.
And you'll see I did like about three podcasts, and Markham keeps asking me when we're going to do one. In fact, Doug La Follette, swear to God, the Secretary of State of Wisconsin, pinged me on Skype about a week ago, and said, "Hey, how about we do some more podcasts about the upcoming elections in the U.S.?" And I said, "Well, Doug, look, most of my podcast energy is going into this Caesar show right now. If you can find a way to tie it into Julius Caesar,
then boom,
we'll get you on as a VIP guest."
Yeah.
And he said, "Oink," which is something that he says in text, in emails, and Skype a lot. I don't know.
Is that good? Bad? Yes? No?
I think it's like
I want you.
I think it's his version of like, all right. that's maybe the Wisconsin version.
Well, they need a new version. They really need to work on that.
All right, I'm going to add Mike Duncan. Everybody,
all right,
wet your pants. Here is Mike Duncan on the show. All right, Mike Duncan.
Hello.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am great. How are you guys?
Good. I'm Cameron. The other one is Ray. We were just talking, trying to figure out what the Wisconsin... Are you still in Wisconsin, Mike, or are you in Portland, Oregon now?
No, I am in Wisconsin.
Well, that's not what your Skype account says. It says Portland.
Oh, really?
Very confusing.
Okay, well, so it's been 6 years since I've updated my Skype account.
I was just saying to Ray that the Secretary of State of Wisconsin, Doug La Follette, is a friend of mine. I've done some podcasts with him, and... we were talking about getting him on the Life of Caesar show as a VIP guest last week, and he replied, "Oink." And we were just trying to figure out if "oink" is the Wisconsin version of all right.
Oink? Or is it bad? Oink.
Oh, man, I have no idea. I've been here for a year and a half. Okay. I just have started teaching myself how to make beer cheese soup. That's as far as I've gotten.
What? Beer cheese soup?
Beer cheese soup is like it's the house soup every restaurant you go to.
Hold
here
on, I've got to translate your accent, Mike. Are you saying bear as in a big furry thing that stands on two legs? Is it bear cheese or beer as in free as in beer cheese?
Beer cheese.
Beer as cheese.
The drink. Beer cheese soup.
Holy shit! Where has that been?
Beer is the liquid and cheese is the flavor.
I'm moving to Wisconsin. Doug La Follette told me about beer cheese soup.
It's a pretty nice state. I've put on like 10 pounds since I got here.
Road trip.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mike Duncan, welcome to our little show. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. Right about now, our entire audience sort of wetting themselves. You have more fangirls than Matthew McConaughey. What's up with that, Mike?
Good, that's to be expected, I think.
All right.
But you did it through history.
Yeah, and
that's the puzzling thing, yeah.
So before we get into talking about Caesar, I want to talk about the History of Rome podcast a bit, if we may.
Yeah, are we doing this thing now? Is this Is this all going into the VIP thing?
Yeah, we've been doing it for 2.5 minutes.
Okay, fantastic. Okay,
this is how we roll, Mike.
I'll professionalize myself here a little bit.
No, please don't. We don't want you to professionalize yourself, Mike. We want to loose and free. This is how we roll.
I should preface this though by saying that I do have a 2-year-old one room over. So gotcha. If in the background there's occasional screaming and or things hitting the wall, that would be him.
Well, that's disclaimer. Or it could just be Ray. He does a lot of that on the podcast. I've got a 5-month-old I just put down upstairs, Mike, so I could have the same. Mike, let's talk about the genesis of the History of Rome podcast. What inspired you? When did you start, and what inspired you to start?
It started in July of 2007. And so this is early-ish days of podcasting. Where the things that were out there, the one that I hit upon was 12 Byzantine Rulers, right. Which you guys know that show, I'm sure.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And then I hit on that and then started like scouring for other history podcasts that I could possibly listen to. Some of them I thought were really good and some of them I thought were really bad. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, I could probably do better than the worst of these.
Yeah. Which one of those two did my Napoleon podcast fit into?
Oh, Mike? hey, the Napoleon podcast was pretty inner circle at that point. I mean, Hardcore History and Napoleon podcast and 12 Byzantine Rulers. I mean, those were kind of the juggernauts when I started.
Just checking.
But I don't really care about Napoleon, so.
What? All right, that's the show, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, thank you for coming, Mike. I appreciate it.
No, so I went looking. I'm obviously a really big Roman history buff, and I went looking for whatever the Roman history podcast was because I was sure that there would be something out there already, and there just kind of wasn't. And so I had been reading a bunch of the old Latin histories, right? I was kind of reading Livy for fun. It's like, wow, okay, nobody's ever heard any of these stories, and there isn't a Roman history podcast, and you know, maybe I should just sit down and start putting out episodes. And that's really how it started.
Nature abhors a vacuum, right? So you
So I got in right at that perfect moment when, you know, if I had not done it, I would say within a year, some kind of major Roman history podcast would have come out eventually.
Yeah.
I can honestly say the same, even though this is a show about you, Mike, I can honestly say the same thing. I got an iPod. I was very excited. I found out what podcasts were. I just knew there was a World War II podcast somewhere out there, and there wasn't. So I said, if Mike can do a narrative, that's what I call it, if he can do a narrative history of the history of Rome, then what's to stop me besides mispronunciations of doing World War II?
Well, that never stopped me, so.
Good for you.
Well, that's it, right? It's funny because that was exactly what happened to me, but it was in November 2004. I started listening to podcasts in about, I think I got back from Rome in about August 2004, discovered podcasts and thought, well, what are the Australian podcasts? And there were no Australian podcasts, so I started the first Australian podcast in November 2004 just for that same sort of, well, shit, no one else is doing it. I might as well do it, right? That's the spirit of podcasting,
there's basically no startup costs. There's no institutional barriers to doing it. You just, if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, then you move on to something else. And for all of us, it sort of worked.
Right.
Well, not to the extent of the History of Rome podcast. So what do you put down as the key success factors of the History of Rome podcast? Is it just your enormous talent?
Good looks. I think in there, yeah, for sure.
Uh-huh. Hence the women.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Right? Yeah, a striking resemblance to Matthew McConaughey.
All right, all right, all right.
I knew it. No, go ahead.
Well, when I had listened to podcasts previously, there were a couple of things that I decided that I would do, and one is that I would always post on a schedule on time. That seemed to be really, really important because you would go back and you would listen to, you know, you'd pick something and there'd be 20 back episodes and every single one of them would start with, oh, okay, well, this episode's late and, you know, here are the reasons why. And, you know, if you're trying to actually build a listener base or any kind of following, you know, you got to give them some kind of regular schedule to like get used to it and sort of expect when the show is going to come out. And then if the show becomes unreliable, then people are just going to drift away. So I think that being like really super reliable about putting out the shows on Sunday night has been a big, big part of it. And then the other thing is I'm just all content, right? I say, hi, welcome to the show. And then I just start talking about whatever we're talking about that week. And then I go until the end and then I say, okay, we'll see you next week. So I try to, there's not a lot of filler
right.
in the narratives, but, and a lot of that is because I script everything. I'm not just, I don't just fire up the microphone and start talking. I have everything pretty well scripted. So I can do that.
So what you're basically saying is the success of the History of Rome podcast is that you did everything completely different to the way that Ray and I do our podcasts. Oh no!
Well, hey, it's my little secret sauce.
Okay,
that's for everyone.
Preparation and not going off on tangents. Who would have ever thought that you could do a podcast that way?
Yeah. I don't think he's right. But Mike, the one thing I knew you were not going to say was promotion, because I heard an interview you did on the 411 on podcast, and you were saying that you simply do not have time for promotion, and that you just put out your content, you just do that. And I think it's hilarious or ironic that we're going to sit here and talk about a man who always found time to promote himself. He was a good general, he was a good leader, he was a good speaker, but Caesar always found time to make sure everyone knew what he was doing, or at least put it in the best possible light as possible.
I would agree with that completely. I am not following Caesar's model to getting stabbed 23 times at the floor of the Senate.
Good on you.
Yeah, right. I'd rather keep going. Thank you very much.
There you go.
Well, let's talk about JC. Mike, in terms of the history of Rome, where does JC fit in? He's obviously the one person that most people are familiar with, but in terms of the entire arc of Roman history, where do you think he sits in terms of importance?
Well, he's top five, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and he is the pivot point.
Yeah.
Of the entire history of Rome pivots on Caesar. But there's like that connection, him and Augustus together did it, Augustus completes this transition that Caesar really sort of launches. Mm. So that's the pivot point of the entire history of Rome. If you're telling the story, in the big picture, I mean, you got Romulus, and then you come down to like Publius Valerius, that little clique of guys that overthrows the kings Then you've got Marcus Furius Camillus, right? Was really hugely super important until Scipio comes along, and then it's Marius and Sulla, and then Caesar. So he's in a pantheon of like these once every about 100 years, somebody will come along, and then after him is, let's see, the five good emperors. How do you pick which one of them? And then Diocletian,
right?
And Constantine. That little connection between Diocletian and Constantine, right? So there's this like once every 100 years or so, there's usually like one or two guys around that really transforms what had come before and turns it into something different. But of those, I mean, Caesar he's a giant. He is a colossus.
Wow. If I can ask a question, it's kind of dovetails into that. I was going to basically ask, I guess, according to that answer, in some ways, Caesar isn't that much different than the other Romans around him, or maybe he was, I don't know, but he was just really good at propaganda and a really good soldier and a general. And so for those reasons, he stands out. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was really super lucky.
Right.
And I mean that honestly, like as great of a general as he was, he had mm-hmm. a couple of moments where he very right. easily the whole thing could have just like collapsed all around him and he'd be dead.
Right.
You know, tried and exiled or whatever they would have done to him had he even gotten to that point.
Right.
So, yeah, but really, really super lucky.
It scares me that he actually factored that into his tactics and strategy. Okay, I'm going to try this. Who knows? But, hey, I've been lucky before. I think it's going to work out fine.
Yeah. But he, you know, Caesar is one of those guys, you know, there's that cliche that, like, luck is the residue of design. Mm-hmm. that he, like, it, it certainly when it comes to what happened to him in battles, right, with little fortunes tending to favor him, like, he had his guys so well drilled, and they could move so fast, and they were so loyal that, you know, once you go up against the you know, Pompey's armies that are that seem to be so good on paper, like, his little unit is just better. They're just better at it, and that that had a lot to do with it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, I know that Napoleon was a big believer in luck as well. Like, incredible amounts of preparation, but he always believed that at the end of the day, when you're on the battlefield, it was just a matter of luck. And at the end of his career, he talked about how his star had deserted him, that his time was up. He kind of knew that things had moved on.
Yeah, well, maybe he shouldn't have kept going. Maybe he should have consolidated a little bit, you know?
If he knew the star was leaving him, maybe he should have just stopped right there.
You know, maybe...
If you're not careful, Duncan, this is going to turn into the Napoleon podcast.
Talleyrand told him. Talleyrand was right.
Talleyrand. Don't get me started on Talleyrand.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Anyway, keeping on track here. What's one of the things I'm always thinking about, Mike, is why Caesar does stand out so much to us in an historical context. I mean, we talk about the fact that he's the pivot point. And without Julius, there would be no Augustus. I think it's fairly safe to say he laid the groundwork. But there were so many giant figures in Roman history. Why do you think we remember Julius above everybody today? Is it because Shakespeare wrote a play about him? If Shakespeare had written a major play about Cicero or Sulla, would we remember him as much? Or do you think Julius really was that stood that far above everybody else in terms of his achievements?
Well, that's a big question. When I think about Caesar, I do think about him as being... He's so much more. There's nothing cardboard cut. He's not two dimensional. He's really, really three dimensional as a figure, in that he's really smart. He's not evil, but he's not really good. He's great at politics. He has great reform ideas, but he's also ruthless. Like, he's just this really, really complicated, complex, and incredibly charismatic guy. In a way that a lot of the other Romans, I mean, Pompey is, you know, he's kind of a block of wood when you when you really think about who he is. You know, Crassus was just this, you know, kind of one-dimensional money grubber who never quite got the recognition he thought he deserved. You know, so there's so much more going on inside of Caesar, and then he beat everybody from that era, and that era itself is so well documented that we know him so much better than a lot of the other figures.
But I wonder,
I'm not sure if that's a good answer, but it's an answer.
Well, I wonder if Pompey or Crassus's commentaries had survived history, where they were able to tell the story from their own perspective and put their own PR spin on it, if we would remember them differently than when we learn about them via Cicero or Suetonius or Caesar, if we're getting a cut down version of their true personality. But as you say, Caesar did win at the end of the day. So, well, until he was
killed. Yeah. And like, I mean, as you guys have commented, right, like his ability to propagandize himself and like his writing style, you know, you can't go back. I don't read Latin. I've talked to people who are, you know, fluent in Latin, and, you know, going back and trying to read Cicero is an enormous pain. His sentences are so convoluted. He's like basically inventing words. He uses the most archaic forms of everything imaginable. And Caesar just wrote this really super basic, direct language that anybody can read. It's like, you know, it's what they teach, like first year Latin. You're reading Caesar's version of history. So, because it's readable, because it is so incredibly readable, just to the average student who's picking it all up for the first time. So when you think about how much more reach his own voice had compared to everybody else, yeah, I mean, And then all the emperors, like, they take his name, right? So where does Caesar come from? It goes back to this guy, Julius Caesar.
Yeah. Why do you think his name became a title?
Probably it just comes from it being a title used by Augustus right off the bat.
Mm.
Right? Because, I mean, nobody called him Octavian. Nobody called him Octavius. Nobody called him, I guess in the end he was referred to as Augustus. But he put himself out there as Julius Caesar, as this name and this title, and that just became synonymous with the imperial, the imperial seat of power. You called yourself Caesar.
So when he was a kid, after Caesar's death, he's able to get a lot of mileage out of, hey, call me Caesar. But then over the decades, he's able to add on to his own prestige to that name, which I guess in a way then becomes a title. So yeah, he certainly got out a lot of it when he was young.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking Augustus?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Augustus's entire early career is entirely based on him using that name in particular. Yeah. And then you can't really talk about what Julius Caesar did as a transformative moment in Roman history without then having Augustus come in and solidify everything and systematize everything and accumulate all the powers of Rome into one seat, also connected to this name Caesar.
Right, your turn.
Okay. We don't really want people to ever get the wrong impression of us. And we're not big, we're not fanboys of Caesar. It's not like we think everything he did was great and all his enemies were bad. I mean, that's just not the way life works. But as far as you, what are your feelings about Caesar? I mean, there's probably things to admire, things not, but you probably, I'm guessing, don't turn away from the negative things he did, especially in Gaul with the butchery and stuff like that. Do you just kind of accept him as face value, or... Because I know some people put him on a pedestal.
Yeah. There's things about him. I mean, that genocide that went on up in northern Gaul, right? And so it's been a couple years since I've gone through the Gallic Wars, day by day.
Sure.
But that was after the attack on that legion over the winter.
Right.
I think that was Cicero's brother, right? So Cicero's brother was running that fort, and then they got attacked, and then Caesar came in with this punitive, genocidal campaign. That was shocking even to people at the time. That word gets back to Italy that he's done this, and they're like, wow. That's kind of over the line there, man. So it's not like, oh, that's just how the Romans roll. There's that old quote, the Romans, they make a desert and call it a peace. Well, the Romans didn't really do that much of the time, unless you kept, not doing what they wanted you to do. If you played ball with the Romans, they didn't want to come in and exterminate you. That wasn't how they did things. So for him to have done that, it was really bad. The thing that has always kind of bugged me about Caesar is how much of everything that happened was just because he was going to personally lose face, right? There goes, can you hear my dog back there?
Oh yeah.
That's not the 2-year old?
Yeah, no, that's not the 2-year old. I'm sure a postman just came or something. But Caesar was facing a personal loss of prestige. His career was gonna fall apart. He was maybe going to be prosecuted. He was going to lose all his money, lose everything. And so he plunges the entire empire into civil war to save his own skin. How many people died? How much devastation was wrought over this just because he himself was afraid of being prosecuted by the Senate, and he didn't want that.
So what do you think the worst thing that could have happened to him? Maybe exiled, banished, his property stripped, his honor and his name, removed or do you think they would have killed him? I know there are people who wanted to kill him, but he was probably looking at banishment is what
I'm guessing. Yeah, I don't know what ultimately because they had some very – they were going to prosecute him for all that business. I think the thing they were going to nail him for was all the business that he conducted when they declared all the holy days during his consulship. Mm-hmm. I think that was the official legal thing they were going to do to him. So I'm sure there was some prescribed – punishment for violating, holy days. Banishment, loss of that, because he wanted to be the man, and you just take away his ability to be the man, and he couldn't face just being some guy living in a house someplace in Spain or wherever.
Yeah.
That was like bringing RICO charges against Al Capone. We're going to get him on tax dodging.
Exactly. Yeah. And what did they really have? Like, what did he really do besides that, which was just a political trick job anyway, you know?
Yeah.
He ignored their kind of blatantly unethical attempt to not let him do what he should have been able to do as consul.
So can you lay the blame at his feet then, Mike? I mean, we all know that last sort of the last century before Caesar, the Republic, the late Republic, was an absolute mess. People fighting against each other, violence in the streets, Clodius, etc. Ex-consuls being banished, assassinated. I mean, mm-hmm. somebody had to clean it up. Can we say that Caesar was just the guy that thought he would take a broom to the late Republic?
Yeah, well, I don't... It's hard to tell exactly what he thought, because you can't really get inside of his head, you know, what he actually thought was going to come of, like, plunging into Italy at that moment. Mm-hmm. I really doubt that he could have foreseen everything that was about to happen. Mm. But yeah, going back to trying to lay blame. The Senate in the whole last century BC, where they were just so rigid and so unwilling to compromise mm-hmm. about even the smallest little thing that they set themselves up hugely to have somebody come at them
right.
with legions. Yeah. I mean, you had the social war. That was mm-hmm. the social war, which is back 90-ish, you know, mm-hmm. 90, 92, somewhere in there. That was one of the greatest unforced errors in history. There's no reason to not extend citizenship to the Italians at that moment. Right. They just didn't want to do it. And then they fight a war for 2 years. And in the end, they say, okay, well, you can have citizenship because duh. Right. That was going to happen. That had to have happened. That was going to happen. So just they could have cut off so many avenues of sort of resentment that then built up and found a force in Caesar and then Augustus and Antony and like everything that happened. They had so fatally compromised their own authority that, they set themselves up for it in a big way.
So what Rome did. I guess some of the stupid things that Rome did as a country because of their pride, in some ways Caesar did as an individual because of his pride, and he's just a good mirror for the culture of Rome at the time. He was simply just not going to back down, and he was going to come out on top and come hell or high water. And then you end up with massive civil war and lots of deaths and destruction, and life as we know it is interrupted, you know, for a very long time.
Yeah, he crossed the Rubicon 49. I mean, Augustus is consolidating power like in 27, right? Like mm-hmm. it's an entire generation of civil war, which is, you know, by far the worst kind of war. I mean, there's that's one. I mean, going through the history of Rome, like nothing. I think there's nothing so traumatic and terrifying and horrible as a civil war. Because it's in kind of a ruthlessly crass way, you don't get anything from it. They go out on these foreign wars, at least they come back with like slaves and gold.
Right.
You get nothing, just destroying yourself.
Unless you're the winner.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the one guy who comes out on top himself, but like the empire or whatever nation you have itself is just usually left in decimated. Blistering ruin. It's completely worse than it was going into it.
Yeah. Which I think is why I'm not sure of this 100%, but I think they weren't supposed to have triumphs for the winners of civil war. Cause who wants to celebrate, you know, Romans killing other Romans. Mm. I think at first they kind of took a dim view of that.
You were absolutely not allowed to have a triumph if you beat another Roman general. And I think Sulla it was really super controversial that he included Marius in his as one of his conquered foes, and that was like a really huge faux pas.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fairly sympathetic to guys like Caesar and Alexander and Napoleon, because I think if you go back into their era, and I know there's a big gap between those eras, but this idea of the great man theory of history, you know, I'm sure it was a big deal in Caesar's day, the memory of the Brutus overthrowing the kings, Superbus and those guys after the Rape of Lucretia, etc., that when there are problems in society, one great man needs to stand up and take it all on his shoulders. You know, needs to carry the world like Atlas on his shoulders and clean it up, fix the messes. We have this 21st century model of democracy and voting and everyone coming together, and let's change things gradually and peacefully. And I think these guys had a very different way of looking at what were the forces that shaped the world. And I can imagine Caesar standing on the non-Italian side of the Rubicon and just going, okay, well, it's up to me. Somebody has to fix things, and I guess it falls on my shoulders because I am the greatest man in Rome right now. I'm the smartest, I'm the most successful, whatever he told himself in his quiet moments.
And in his defense, he kind of was a lot of those things. He was, I think, a more creative thinker than any one of those other guys. I think he was absolutely more creative than all of them practically put together. And the stuff that he did bring into reform, all of it almost uniformly was like good.
Yeah.
The stuff he was trying to do.
For years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he really did have a program. And I think in a vacuum, you know, the best form of government is enlightened, you know, an enlightened despotism, right? The philosopher king.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you would want, but those guys exist so rarely. And usually it winds up so badly because they can only do it for so long before it all, you know, you can't keep it going forever.
Yeah.
Except Augustus. Augustus somehow just kind of kept it going forever. That guy just kept living and living. It's insane. Like that is so important.
Well, we've got this theory that they were vampires. I don't know if you subscribe to the vampire theory.
I actually heard that. Yeah, because Caesar doesn't need to sleep or eat.
Uh huh.
And he can travel at night.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. The vampire theory of history. That's what we base everything on. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Augustus thing is nuts because he died like almost every 6 months until he was about 25 years old. And then he just lived to be like 100.
Yeah, but it was his longevity, I guess you could say, that everybody was getting used to the idea of, even if it was unofficial, a one-man rule kind of.
Yeah, because by the time that he died, the people who were, you know, coming up in the world, who were now like kind of middle-aged, who were, you know, late 30s, early 40s, those guys had completely grown up under the system. It was completely now entrenched. There was no, you know, there was always these sort of romantic calls to maybe go back to the old ways, but that it was never going to work after that.
Yeah,
and all of the state propaganda for their entire lives had been, wow, isn't Augustus great? Isn't this great that we don't have all of the problems that we had during the late Republic? It must have been very hard. It's a bit like living in our era, the amount of pro-Western way of doing things propaganda that we're subjected to every minute of our lives. It's very different to start to think outside of the box, go, well, maybe communism is okay. Maybe socialism has some merits. Maybe we should think about the positive things when you're just you're being crushed by propaganda every day.
Yeah, and even the stuff it's so below the surface, you don't even realize that you're like being indoctrinated into something. When I was researching the French Revolution, I'm like going through the old Enlightenment guys, sort of in the 1740s, 1750s, and you hit on this guy who literally, he invented the notion of progress, right? Like the philosophical notion of progress, that things are getting better and that we should always be improving them, and that we should always be looking at stuff and trying to make things better, faster, more efficient, whatever, just this idea of progress. And, you know, you go, oh, okay, well, that's entirely what our society is based off of now. And it really is just an idea that it has not been around since day one. It actually is just a particular facet of Western capitalist civilization at this moment in history.
But there was a time in history where that, for the vast majority of history, where people didn't think that way, right?
Yeah, people didn't think of progress as being the natural order of things.
Right, because that's so that idea. Sure,
and I'm into progress. I love progress. I think progress is great.
Because that idea is so intertwined with us today, you almost think of it as a natural law and not an idea. You know,
And I don't. So. And I think coming across that moment in history where somebody literally thought it up and started propagating it, as a philosophy, is like, oh right, this isn't just this isn't in there with the law of gravity. It's just a philosophy that we choose to run our society by.
There was something
which, again,
is
fine because it gives us computers and podcasts and stuff, and we can talk to each other across the world, which is insane.
Yeah, we're on three different parts of the world right now. Yeah, we're talking. So, what do you think about the idea of Winston Churchill's? I guess his one of his ideas when he was writing was, and this is kind of hard for me, I'll admit it, is to not judge people when you're writing about someone in the past, to not judge them by today, your current day standards, and to remember what it was like for them. I mean, we joke around, we talk about Caesar a lot, but it's kind of hard, especially now that he's in Gaul and there's a lot of horrible things going on. It's hard not to judge by today's standards because, that's kind of what we do, but you almost have to remember not to do that. He was in a different time, in a different world, in a different position, and he was just doing what maybe somebody in that place in that time would do in given those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, it's hard to completely separate your own, moral code from whoever you happen to be reading about. But yeah, you should always judge people by the standards of their own era.
Yeah.
And anytime people get too far gone on a judgment trip on somebody for whatever reason, how terrified are you of the things that they're going to be looking at us for 200, 300, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now? Do you ever dig around in your own backyard and see the terrible things that we do? That they're just going to say, wow, guys.
Yeah. You didn't want gays to be married? What's up with that?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, yeah, there's bigger. I won't get into the other stuff.
Get into the other stuff, Mike. It's just, get into it.
Touches on some fairly sensitive. Get into it, Mike. Temporary political issues that would.
Come on, Mike. Let it go, Mike. Let it go. This isn't maybe your show. You're not gonna lose any of your audience, and our audience already are used to being offended. Come on.
Well, they wouldn't be offended, but so what would it be? It would I think the first thing would be the factory farming complex.
Right.
I think is going to be just so horrific that people down the road are going to look back and just be like, you did what? And that's how you got your food? That's insane. That's so wrong. You just let it happen every day. Oh, yeah, every day. Just went to the store and bought it. Yeah, no big deal.
What else, Mike?
I'm going to cut myself off.
Oh, come on, Mike.
I'll leave it with what we're doing to the poor pigs and chickens.
Right. My wife would agree with you.
Let's get into the military industrial complex, Mark.
No, because they're listening to us right now.
I don't think that they'll look at the military industrial complex 500 years from now and say that was a terrible thing that you just let go on, because just sort of always been a thing.
You don't think the Gene Roddenberry future, where we're much more enlightened and realize that was all.
History. I have two future projections. One is very optimistic and one is very pessimistic.
What are they?
Oh, well, just in the pessimistic one is the dystopian Orwellian, nightmare that could very easily grow out of everything that's going on right now. And then the optimistic one is that you have science that somehow reformulates with the natural world, and we become a completely sustainable, enlightened, race of super beings.
With a benign AI dictator.
Sure. Benign, we'll get into psionics and, the whole nine yards.
All right, Ray, you can get it back on track now, Ray.
Okay. Thank you. There was a thing we were talking about earlier. Yeah, exactly. I would have loved to have been there the moment that when Caesar crosses the Rubicon and the Boni, the good men, the conservative element back in Rome, they're talking to Pompey and saying, you know, this is war. He has started war with us, and we want you to lead our troops. And I can just picture Pompey going, you know, we were friends. We were colleagues. I was married to his daughter. I was really awesome when I was young. I was in the East kicking so much butt. And now he is kind of now the first man in Rome. And here's my opportunity to fight literally against him. And I just wonder if we could have been in that room, how big of a smile might have been on Pompey's face. But I couldn't help but thinking, I think it's amazing that he thought he could have won. You know, he almost did in some ways, but I just would have been loved to have been there when he had the chance to strike at the man who had taken his reputation as the first man in Rome from him. I just think that would have been a really neat moment, and I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, that's interesting that he would have a smile on his face. I've never pictured him having a smile.
Maybe he didn't.
On his face.
Yeah, right.
Because
maybe he said, "Oh crap."
Yeah, because I feel like he was kind of done at that point.
Right.
You know, he was retired in almost every sense of the term, and he didn't want to have to go saddle back up and fight Caesar, I don't think.
Maybe I was giving him too much credit then, I apologize.
Yeah, especially because, you know, when Caesar's come, Caesar, through that entire campaign, is so deep inside of Pompey's head that I can't imagine that Pompey wasn't somewhat aware of the fact that he was basically scared of Caesar.
Right.
Because, you know, he gets this report that, you know, Caesar has crossed the Rubicon with a single legion. And he's like, well, that can't possibly be true because, you know, nobody would be crazy enough to actually do that.
Right.
So I won't just take these two legions that I have right here and just go beat him. So Caesar must be up to something deeper and more complex and more sinister. This must be some kind of disinformation campaign that he's created to trick me into coming up there. So I'll retreat from Italy. So he retreats with the entire Senate before the combined forces of a single legion.
Wow.
And then he crosses, and they have that the battle of Dyrrhachium, which was the little trench battle that they had, and Pompey beat him. Pompey beat him at Dyrrhachium. Caesar's fleeing, and Pompey won't go after him and win the thing because Pompey believes that Caesar is luring him into a trap. And then you get to, so there's two times right there in a row where like Pompey is just, he's outsmarting himself because he's so afraid of what he thinks Caesar is going to possibly do to him.
Wow.
And then you get to the big showdown, and Pompey didn't even want to fight that battle. He had to be forced into it. Now, he was right. He shouldn't have fought that battle, but they did have overwhelming numbers. Pompey just wanted like 10 times the number of guys Caesar had. then he would have finally felt comfortable taking the field against this guy.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I always felt that Pompey was sort of forced into that situation, partly by the Senate, partly by his reputation, and he was the only guy really that somebody had to be put in the position of leadership to defend Rome against Caesar's oncoming troops. But I always got the impression that he didn't want to do it. It was you know, he put on a brave face. And made a lot of big statements, but really he was not happy about the whole deal.
Yeah, and the senators that were surrounding him basically forbade him from having direct contact with Caesar. Caesar's sending, like when Pompey and the Senate, they're still in Italy, they're down in Brindisi. And Caesar's now, I think, in Rome at this point, or at least now coming down after them. And he's sending messages to Pompey directly saying, dude, we have a lot of history. We have, as you said, you were married to my daughter and we did all of this stuff together. And if we could just sit down in a tent and talk, like we could solve this all in 5 minutes and we wouldn't have to do all this stuff. And the Senate said no, because they were, I think, probably justifiably concerned that if Pompey ever got into a tent with Caesar, he'd come out 5 minutes later and say, like, Caesar wins. He gets everything he wants. I said, can I go home now? Can I go have my sandwich that I've been enjoying exactly. the last couple of years? Like, I don't want
to
do this.
It reminds me very much of, and I hate to do this, but it reminds me of Napoleon and Alexander, the Tsar Alexander, not the great. And in the lead up to Napoleon's invasion of Russia, he's sending letters to Alexander going, dude, why are you building up troops on the border of Poland? Hey, I want to marry your sister. Hello, is there anyone out there? And he's getting nothing back. And Alexander's got the same, Alexander's fear is if he talks to Napoleon, Napoleon will schmooze him, and then he'll get assassinated like his dad did by the Russian nobility for giving in. So he breaks off all communication. Napoleon has to do what he has to do because there's no communication coming back. And I think it was similar with Caesar and Pompey. Pompey was forced into this situation.
Yeah, and Caesar himself is so, like, personally charismatic and so personally persuasive, that yeah, there's not a lot of people that he that could match wits with him, and he right. I mean, Caesar got his way when he wanted it.
So here's a question: what do you think? Let's play alt history for a second. If Pompey had sat down with Caesar and they'd had a chat, and Pompey had come out, as you say, and go, Caesar wins, I'm going to go have a sandwich. What happens next? Does Caesar become dictator, or does he just say, okay, well, I want to become consul, like that was the plan, I want to run for consul again so you can't arrest me and put me on trial? Does he just run for consul and, you know, that takes a year, and then he goes off and becomes proconsul of
somewhere,
the land of tin?
Yeah, I, you know what, I honestly do not know what would happen at that point, because what he wanted was to run for consul again to keep his immunity going. And then, run for consul, sit on it for a bit, get another 10-year-long appointment, maybe make send him money over to Egypt. Maybe he would have taken over the East, you know? He goes and becomes proconsul of Egypt. The Senate is happy that he's far away in the East. He consolidates that. And, then he fathers a new line of Ptolemies, something along that line. There you go. How's that?
Yeah. If I could, what we were talking about a second ago about Caesar being a smooth talker or whatever, I think the third podcast that you should do after revolutions is the effect of the charming man on history, or the effects of charm throughout history. Because, you know, Napoleon was charming, Caesar was charming. Even to a certain degree, Hitler was able to talk people into stuff. He might talk to you for 3 hours, but, give a speech and yell at you, whatever, but some people are just born and they just have the gift of gab or can schmooze and charm. And it's just amazing how that changes things that may not have happened if those people didn't have that degree or that degree of charm.
Yeah, that would be a really interesting angle to take on a ton of these moments, right? Yeah. And then you get, you know, because you would have you might even be able to compare it. Like, you would have these moments where, like, the super charming person then is removed from the scene and gets replaced by somebody who's just wooden, and everything starts to fall apart, or whatever the objective was just gets completely lost. I can see that for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's
trademark.
It's time, Mike, to move on to listener questions.
Oh, okay. Listener questions.
So the people on our Facebook page are asking some questions. I'm going to run through them. James Lasecki asks, when was your oh crap moment? When did you realize the size of the beast you were taking on with the history of Rome?
there actually is an oh crap moment. The oh crap moment was Julius Caesar's first year in the consulship. It was when that episode... I'd been moving along at a pretty good clip where episodes seemed to cover, you know, 2, 3, maybe even 5 years, depending on, you know, how much happened, like through the Samnite Wars, through all that early stuff. And it was moving along at a pretty good clip. And then I got to that first year of Caesar's consulship, and it took me an entire episode to get through that one, you know, really like 8-month period. And I was like, well, this is going to take a little bit longer than I thought. Because it's not like the documentation gets less as you move, like as you get into that era and into the, like the Julio Claudians and the Flavian, you know, the Antonines, it's not like there's less to talk about. So the early stuff, I was able to kind of move steadily through because there's just, there's only a few sources. There's only so much we know about it. But yeah, once I got to Julius Caesar's first year in the consulship, that was definitely when I stopped trying to project how long it was going to take me to finish. And I was just said, it'll take as long as it takes.
Is that really...
Which turned out to be like 3.5 more years.
Is that really where history starts? Do you think... I haven't really thought about this before, so it's maybe a stupid comment, but listeners won't be surprised by me making stupid comments. But do you think this is where history starts with Caesar? Pre-Caesar, and I know what you mean, because when we did sort of the lead up to Caesar, we're talking about Marius and Sulla and this kind of stuff. It does go quite quickly because there's not a lot, at least contemporary stuff that's recorded. Then there's later historians that write about it. But once we hit Caesar, we've got his commentaries, we've got Cicero's letters and his speeches, etc. And then it just starts to balloon from there. Is this where our, you know, modern version of history really starts with primary sources, etc.?
Well, I think it's more like a window opened up, like a super detailed, super well documented window, because that window closes eventually. Where you, I mean, even you try to take on the crisis of the third century, there's like no records for that. And after kind of the fall of the West, you could probably move at a much quicker clip again because the documentation has gotten so much worse. And then if you go back before Caesar, I mean, you look at like the Greeks. You know, you take the Peloponnesian War, like that's a whole era of like 100 years where we know what's going on there, like day by day.
Yeah.
And then a couple of centuries will pass and we won't know a ton about it. So I think it's definitely clearly a big reason why, you know, if you just quiz the average person, what do you know about Roman history? 90% of what they know is going to fall between about 50 BC and 50 AD. Like every person that they know and every event that they know, aside from like Hannibal, usually falls in about that century. And it is because I think it's so crazily well documented.
Except for the whole Jesus stuff, where there is no documentation, but people still believe that's history. But don't get me started on that.
I won't.
Good.
I didn't even come close to getting you started on that.
I'll get myself started on it if you give me enough time. Damien's
a self-starter.
Damien Marcius Alexander Mitchell asks, if one thinks about the great men view of history, not something I wholly subscribe to, by the way, he says, three figures jump to the tongues of laymen, Napoleon, Alexander, and Caesar. To your mind, what traits/characteristics, if any, do they share? And what does Caesar have that's peculiar to him compared to the others? Excellent question, Damien.
Wowzers. Okay, so a psychological profile of the three greatest men in history. with all biographical
references. Sum it up in 30 seconds if you can.
With footnotes. Yeah.
I'll start working right now. Well, they, as we've talked about, I think they all, let's say this, they were all incredibly charming, personally, like in a room, just conversationally, and they were all really smart. They were all insanely ambitious. They all, man, like, cause, you know, Alexander, I know, but not quite as well. And Napoleon, you know, is Napoleon. What did they have? They won battles.
Yeah.
Boy, they could every single one of those guys could win a battle like nobody's business. Right. And was just better than anybody else on the field at the time. That's 50% of everything that they have to go on. They won. They just kept winning. So what's that? Did they have some special quality that allowed them to win? I don't know.
What do you think about the psychopath theory? Were all three of those guys psychopaths? Were they particularly unempathetic? You know, there is. I've got a friend of mine, a dear American fellow. He's in his late 80s, And he keeps telling me off for doing podcasts about Napoleon and Caesar. Why don't you talk about the good people in history and not the evil tyrants of history? And I keep saying, well, dude, you gotta, I mean, these guys, I don't think of them as evil tyrants for a start. I think of them as men of their era who did some good things, did some bad things, but left a massive impact on history. But do you think we can look at them as psychopaths in a way? Were they broken or were they brilliant?
My gut reaction to that would be that I don't think that they're psychopaths. Just because if they were psychopaths, then how many other people around them were also psychopaths? So it's, you know, it's the old, like, I'm a baseball guy. There's a thing about Ty Cobb, right? You guys care about baseball?
Nope.
Nobody cares about baseball. Okay, well, maybe somebody out there cares about baseball. So there's a deal. Ty Cobb, he's like this super racist, terrible, horrible human being. He was violent. He was all of these things. And everybody knows this about Cobb, that he was like this horrible, horrible person. Mm-hmm. But if you actually go back and look at, you know, ball players from the 10s and the teens and the 20s, right? Like, Ty Cobb is fairly pedestrian for his age, right? He wasn't the most violent guy in the league, like, by far. He certainly wasn't the most racist guy in the league, like, by far. But because he was so good, he becomes representative. He's the one we know about from that era. And then we go back and look at the stuff that he said and did. Like, he beat up a crippled guy. You know, you can't do that anymore. But the crippled guy was yelling at him, right?
Why did you say
ticked him off?
Why did you sound disappointed when you said you can't do that anymore, Mike?
Why did you beat up crippled people?
You're like, you can't do that anymore.
You can't do that anymore.
That's the only fight I can win.
Even if they've been riding you all day, you can't just walk into the hands and punch a cripple.
What's wrong with society? Yeah, it's turned into a nanny state.
But the thing is that, and it's, I think it's the same for them. Like, Cobb was so great that then we know him, and so we know the stuff that he did and the stuff that he said, and we're like, wow, what a terrible guy.
What an asshole.
And so, yeah, so Napoleon is indifferent to the loss of his men, right? Caesar collapses in an empire, causes civil war because he's pursuing power. Alexander just, you know, can't stop rampaging around. Yeah. But didn't everybody else basically of that more aristocratic leadership clique that's always been running the world, wouldn't any one of them have been fine with that for the most part? Most of them were. You know, wasn't – and like I say, the Napoleonic era is not really my thing. But Wellington was not particularly empathetic to his troops. Isn't that true?
Yeah. Well, he, and particularly later in life, Wellington was known as a complete dickhead.
Yeah, right. You know? I mean, it's, so on both sides of these things, and at every level of command and in every position of power, yeah, I think that the people who tend to rise up and try to do this stuff would be broken compared to the average person who just wants to live their life and, you know, sit on the front porch and have a nice drink. You know, we're not pursuing that stuff. But among the people, among the types of people that go for it, I don't think that they're any more or less than any one of the other guys, or now we have some gals we can throw into that mix.
They would just consider collateral damage, maybe.
Sure. And, you know, by the standards of every one of their times, you know.
Yeah.
That's just how it was.
That's just the way it was. They were just better at it than most. Yeah.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, sure were.
By the way, Damien says, P.S. Please let Mike know that Revolutions is great and I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
Just in case you didn't already know that people enjoyed that show, Damien's throwing his bit in. James Phillips asks to ask you if you're going to cover the French Revolution on your Revolutions podcast, and if you are you going to have Cameron as a special guest? I swear to God I didn't throw that bit in.
How old are these questions?
38 minutes. He obviously hasn't caught up with that episode.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think about anything but the French Revolution right now. I'm amazed I have as much recall about the life of Caesar as I'm apparently I've accessed my cached memory here. Because I don't think about anything but the French Revolution right now.
Yeah. Come on, James.
I was ready to correct you in case you said Pierre or something like that instead of Caesar. I was ready to help you.
So right. Yeah, right. So yeah. So when Caesar storms the Bastille and he says to the people, we need to take down this clique, this bourbon clique.
I was gonna I was gonna send you a text, Mike. Yeah, so I was ready for that.
But Cameron, I did one of the things I do want to get out of this is I have this the end of the show, the end of the French Revolution, is kind of open right now, because there's a couple of different moments that you can point to that separate sort of the revolutionary era from the Napoleonic era, right?
But yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, where would you draw the line between those two?
Well, depending on the mood you got me in, it would be the restoration of the Bourbon monarchy is the end of the revolution.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think of Napoleon as the savior of the revolution, not the end of it.
Okay.
But if you got me in a different mood, I would say when he's crowned emperor, because the France does take on a different flavor. Then it's sort of this crazy hybrid of the revolutionary ideals with the, and which was his intention, I think. Okay, well, France isn't really ready for full on post-revolutionary ideals. We need a hybrid, and also maybe if we have a hereditary crown or hereditary leadership, the rest of the European monarchs will stop fucking with us and just let me get on with running France, which I believe is really what he wanted to do. I see Napoleon as fighting one defensive battle after another from the time he's a lieutenant through to his death, with only maybe one exception, which is the Iberian Peninsula. But even then, I can make a justification for Portugal. But he was just fighting defensive battles all the way along, as the European monarchs were determined not to allow the overthrow of the Bourbon monarchy to succeed because they were worried about what message that would send to their own dominions. Because if the French were successful then in overthrowing their monarchy, then holy shit, what's going to happen in Austria or Russia or England? We can't let this happen. We can't let this idea get out there, which, is a bit like the United States during the late second half of the 20th century with communism and socialism. Well, we can't let that be successful anywhere. If that's successful in Cuba, what will the Americans start thinking? That we don't need to have private enterprise? That capitalism isn't the be-all and end-all? Okay, let's throw everything that we have at destroying any chance of success that communism or socialism has in the places where it's got a foothold, because we just can't allow that to happen.
Well, and if the 20th century has taught us anything, it's that communist Cuba was the death knell of the United States of America.
Wow, dude, we need to do a podcast on that. I tried to.
That was it. Society since that moment has just been torn asunder. Democracy died.
Yeah, collapsed.
All because of Cuba.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Mike Ferris has a question, but I'm not going to ask it because I'm going to ask you that question anyway in our lightning round. Sven,
God, there's a lightning round.
Oh yeah, yeah, there's a lightning round. Get ready for that.
What is the War of 1812?
Yes. Sven Nyholm asks, when it comes to great stories and amusing anecdotes, can MD think of any historical figure who can seriously compete with Caesar, other, of course, than Alexander and Napoleon? I'm sure you can, but tell us one anyway.
Okay, so another super great figure who is on par with Caesar, Alexander, and Napoleon. Wow!
When it comes to anecdotes and things like that, and fun stories.
Oh wait, what's the question again?
Just in terms of other than those three guys, what is one of the great stories or anecdotes of history that you can think of? I mean, we could rattle off, there's Genghis stories, there's Fidel Castro stories. I could tell you 100 Fidel Castro or Che Guevara stories that I think rival them. But outside of those three guys, who's your favorite great figure in history that you could talk about over a beer for an hour?
Oh God, Washington,
right? Mm.
For sure, I'm a very staunch Washington partisan when it comes to like who was the greatest president in American history, and I'll defend him to anybody.
Cool.
Which is funny because in the American Revolution, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who listens to the show, but who I hadn't talked to for a while, and he was like, "Oh wow, you really hate George Washington, don't you?" because I apparently like I never missed an opportunity to point out something that he had done wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And I think basically what happened is I overcompensated for how much of like a crush I have on Washington. I didn't want that to come through. It's like, wow, this is just turning into this love fest for, you know, Washington. So I was making a point to like, you know, try to look at it from both sides. Right. Maybe I came out a little too hard on. Yeah, totally. But I mean, George Washington is fantastic. I don't think the United States of America exists without him.
Okay.
I mean, he was the center of the entire project. When there was, I mean, I think it's Gary Wills. I might be getting the name wrong. But, you know, like before the United States, there was the Revolution. Before the Revolution, there was Washington. Right. He was the first thing that could really be rallied around. And then he was so aware of how to project himself through all of those years. He was so perfectly designed to play that role and did it so well that coming out the other side of it, you know, when he finally is able to retire, you know, the country is kind of off and running at that point. That I think if he had died or if he had simply not been around, it would have – they probably, A, wouldn't have even ever won the war. And then, B, the country never would have been able to hold together through that first decade.
John Adams really wouldn't have been able to step into that role, would he?
No, not. I mean, first president. I mean, not even Jefferson. They were all at each other's throats. The only guy who nobody. I mean, there was obviously a little clique of anti-Washington people that were in there, but Washington himself was so universally known and beloved, and then never. He was so good at not ever stepping outside of himself. He had so much self-control and so much self-composure that he never overreached beyond his own abilities, because he was not of that group the smartest guy, right? Like some of those dudes running around, you know, in the late 1700s in the colonies were like pretty smart. And he probably wasn't the best soldier necessarily. But the things that he did have and the things that he could do, he did really well. And nothing ever collapsed.
I'm not an expert on this era, but I have read bits, and I always get the sense that he genuinely, like Caesar turned down the crown, and you know, different people throughout history have said, no, I don't want the power, but okay, I'll take it just because you really insisted. I always get the sense from Washington that he really didn't want the responsibility of being the first president, but accepted the fact that he was the right guy. And
he took it on
his shoulders.
He wanted to be the general of the continent. He wanted to be the commander in chief of the Continental Army. That he wanted, absolutely. Right. That wasn't like any business about him being called from the field to go lead the Continental Army. No, like he showed up and wanted the job. But after that, did he want to be president? No, he did not want to be the first president of the United States at all. Because he wasn't a politician. He didn't consider himself a politician. He considered himself a soldier. And once the war was done, he was like, sweet. let's not ever. And they're like, no, do you see?
No, there's more.
You're Washington, right?
Yeah. You're
going to get elected. Do you understand? Yeah. Do you understand?
I always got the impression that every biography I read of him, I always got the impression that he, almost more than anybody else, spent a lot of time almost out of his own skin looking at himself about how he was perceived by everyone. There seemed to be a lot of self-examination going on.
Yeah, definitely. And he was so much about his own image and so much about, just the way that he projected himself. I mean, he had his little rule. You read his little, like, I've got his little rule book for like social interaction. And, you know, he wouldn't be the funnest guy to hang out with. you know, apparently he was a good dancer. And like, so he did that. That was his thing. He was a phenomenal dancer, apparently. All the women loved dancing with him. It's like, you know, don't cross your boots a certain way. Like, always sit like this and make sure your lapel is, you know, faced like that. Because like I say, like he was born to be this stoic Republican figure. It's crazy that he showed up in that time and at that place.
Gotcha.
All right. Now, Ray, unless you've got any more questions for Mike, I think it's time to get into the lightning round.
No, I'm done. Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate it. That was a lot of fun talking to you.
Hey, we're not finished.
No, I know. No,
we still have the lightning round.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying thank you.
You know, and before we go on, because as I was talking about Washington, I was reminded of John Lambert, who I also love, out of the English Civil Wars. Right? Have you guys gone through the English Civil Wars much?
I have. No, okay. I just finished your series.
Yeah, so I think if Lambert had gotten control of the Commonwealth after Cromwell, that it's very possible that they would have just been a republic from there on out.
Wow.
That there might not have been a restoration. Because wow. he had that same combination of like he was a pretty gifted political thinker. He was a great soldier. He didn't lose battles, right? He was winning battles as often for Cromwell. But he had that same combination of like political acumen and military skill. And he was pretty young. I mean, he didn't go crazy for another like 30 years. So I think if Lambert had gotten a hold of the Commonwealth, the entire history of Britain would have been completely different.
One of the great what ifs.
Yeah. Lambert's great. I discovered Lambert when I was working on the show, so I love him.
All right, Mike Duncan, you've made it to the lightning round of the show. Now, in the lightning round, you have 60 seconds to answer as many of the following questions as you can.
Okay, let me get a piece of paper and a pen here.
Take a drink.
It'll help me think.
Sure.
Okay.
Mike Duncan, your time starts now. Caesar, tyrant or reformer?
Reformer.
Was he really the Queen of Bithynia, or was that just slanderous gossip?
No comment.
Does free will exist?
No.
Which interpretation of wave-particle duality do you prefer, the Copenhagen interpretation or the Everett multiple worlds interpretation?
I think I'm with the Copenhagen guys.
Okay, very conservative, fair enough. Drink of choice?
Whiskey on the rocks.
Which whiskey? Be more specific, Mike.
I currently drink Jameson.
Oh, Irish whiskey. Okay, not a single malt guy. All right.
I cannot afford single malt.
Right. I'm sorry.
I have a price point.
You should get a successful podcast like us, and then you can
drink
single malt. Cigar of choice?
Do not smoke.
Ugh. Ray, are you and I the only guys in the world that smoke cigars anymore?
It's getting to that point. Yeah.
Good, all the more for us. Would you rather fight 100 duck-sized horses or one horse-sized duck, Mike?
I would choose not to fight.
Oh, good answer. Step outside the arena. If you had a TARDIS for a day, where would you go and why? This is Mike Ferris's question, but I've repurposed it.
Oh, I've had some good ones. It would be nice to know if Jesus was actually a thing. That'd be nice to find out.
Wow, same answer as our last VIP guest, Tom Holland.
There really?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a burning question.
Yeah. It changes everything if you know the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tom Baker or Peter Capaldi?
What?
Yeah. Okay. Moving on. The Godfather or Citizen Kane?
Oh. Well, ooh, geez Louise. Godfather.
The Beatles or the Stones?
That's a false dichotomy.
Oh, okay. You're stepping out of the battle here many times.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like binary forced choices.
You're the sister.
You know, the thing is, the Beatles were a pop band, and the Stones were a rock and roll band. So they were up to different stuff, and they were both phenomenal. And I don't like the notion that there are Beatles fans and Stones fans. I think the overlap there is about 90% because the Beatles scratch one itch and the Stones scratch another.
You are the Cicero of the lightning round questions, I got to say. Just straddling both worlds simultaneously.
I'm just saying. I love them both. But, give me Sticky Fingers and Sergeant Pepper, and I'm happy.
You're talking about music here or what you do when the lights go out?
No.
You. Little from column A, little from column B.
Julius Caesar and Jesus Christ, same initials, both stabbed in the side by someone named Longinus, both wore a strange crown made out of a plant, both deified after their death. Coincidence or the plot of the latest Dan Brown novel?
Oh, that is a coincidence.
Right. Now, final question. If you could go back in time to 60 BCE and talk to Caesar, what would you tell him?
Oh, man, you're going to make it. you're gonna do it. People are going to be talking about you 2,000 years from now, which is kind of really what you're after here, right?
Exactly.
So there's going to be this. You're going to have it all, man.
You know, I gather the fact that you were shocked or couldn't answer the Tom Baker or Peter Capaldi question, you're not a Doctor Who fan, which is fine. But there's this great episode.
Oh, which is the guy with the scarf?
Tom Baker, man.
Okay, Tom Baker.
There you go. There was an episode a couple of years
ago. I don't watch Doctor Who, clearly.
That's sad, man. For people,
I know. It really sad. Is. It
doesn't have time.
Yeah, well.
It's actually goofy because I really love British television and I really love British science fiction television. Like, I'm borderline obsessed with Red Dwarf.
Oh, my God. Really? That is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That's
Red Dwarf is easily one of my favorite shows of all time. And I just never did Doctor Who, and I will at some point just sit down and start rattling them off one by one.
Well, a good place to start, maybe, look for the episode where he goes back and meets Van Gogh. And the episode is all about Van Gogh being broke and poor and miserable and depressed and no one wants to buy his art and, you know, he's a complete loser. And they take him at the end. They take him, put him in the TARDIS, and they take him to 2010 or whenever the episode was made to a major retrospective of his work at, you know, one of the major museums in London, and let him stand there and watch the curator of the gallery talking about Van Gogh and his brilliance and his genius and his work. And the doctor says to him something like, "You will never be forgotten." And I tear up even right now talking about this. I get squishy eyes. Whenever I see this episode, I tear up. And if you think about that with Caesar, like, imagine being able to bring Caesar into 2014 and say, "We are still talking about what you did." That is phenomenal. It's like people talking about us in the year 4014 or more. I mean, crazy,
might
right?
Not happen.
I mean, sure, I'm sure. The Mike's History of Rome podcast will still
be
have millions of listeners.
It will live on in fragments. They will have lost episodes, you know, 36 to 42, and you know there'll be some, you know, some
what
bad
happened?
Stuff. We don't know what happened. You know, all we have is the little like plugs to go on attached to each episode, right? Oh, the second Sam Knight War. What was that?
Yeah. And who's Audible? What's this Audible?
Yeah, what is it?
Lynda.com, were they his? Did they own him? Was he their slave? I mean, seriously.
But, I mean, as long as civilization exists, Julius Caesar will be talked about. This thing could go on for 10,000 years. They're still going to be talking about. See, they'll always talk about Alexander. Alexander's never going to get forgotten, and Caesar won't either. The Roman Empire was too big, and he was too important. To ever everything else that we could know about Rome could fall away time.
Yeah.
But Caesar will probably still be around forever.
What do you think he would literally? I mean, what would he say? What would he think if we brought him into the 21st century to see how he's remembered? Would he feel the need to defend his legacy? Do you think?
No, I think first of all he would say, "Yeah, well, that seems just about right." I don't think he would be surprised at all. He'd be like, "Yes, that sounds about right. You all continue to write books about me and study my life and legacy, and you know, create new podcasts about me. Yes, that seems perfectly all right."
When did togas go out of fashion? All right, Mike Duncan. Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule in Madison, Wisconsin, and your beer, cheese, soup to come and chat with us. It's been an absolute joy.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
And are you on Twitter, Mike? Can people follow you on anything apart from the podcast?
I am not on Twitter. I don't have a Facebook page. I barely have an email address.
He's focused.
But the show gets out every week, man.
Yeah, that's all you need to know.
I'm not a particularly good.
Yeah.
So.
What do you do for a job, Mike?
Oh, right now?
Yeah.
Right now, I have managed to finagle my way into doing the podcast. And then the boy is in daycare part time, so I watch him half the time.
Right.
And then I do the show the other half of the time. Since when we moved to Wisconsin, I stopped having to have a day job. That was something that
full-time podcaster living the dream.
I was able to work it out for myself. You know, I mean, it's sort of like mostly full-time, but that's what I do. I don't go to work anymore. Nice. Before that, I cut and sold fish.
Wow, fishmonger. I like that.
Fishmonger to podcaster. There's a book in there.
And Mike, this is not a threat, but on your next tour or one of your future tours, Cam and I are going to come with you, and we're just going to pick up this conversation where we left off, okay?
Well, you guys should come on the tour. So I'm trying to fill up spots right now. Yeah. So you can come to England and France. You can come to America and do the American Revolution. That's not too far away from you. We're not going to Virginia, and I do apologize to all the Virginia partisans out there. You know, the Northeast Corridor is very straightforward.
Gotcha.
Thank you, Mike.
So come on the tours. It'll be fun.
Lovely.
All right.
I'd love to. Okay. Have a good one.
All right. Bye, guys.
Shake. If she's listening to the VIP show, I'm not sure if she does. I'm going to give a shout out to Alex Kynaston. Alex sent me an email the other day saying, well, she sent Chrissy actually an email. Alex is in Toronto, Tony Kynaston's daughter. She was saying that she listens to the Caesar show. And she's 15. She loves it. So shout out to Alex out there. She's one of my favorite Alex. People. Yeah. All right. Thanks, man. Good show.
I'll talk to you soon.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.